शांति शांति हरि ओम। सो वी विल कंटिन्यू डिस्कशन ऑन दिस
सेम टॉपिक। सो यस्टरडे आई डिस्कस्ड दिस टू वर्सेस, फर्स्ट टू वर्सेस ऑफ द ईशावास्य उपनिषद। द फर्स्ट वन, ईशावास्यम इदं सर्वं, दैट इज स्टेटमेंट, द फर्स्ट लाइन इज सर्वं, इट मीन्स the entire world is to be seen as enveloped or pervaded by the divine spirit, the central principle. So whatever there is in this world, anything that we see around, including our own physical, psychophysical mechanisms, all these are pervaded by the divine spirit, God. After making this statement, which is really the highest Advaitic experience, is the peak of spiritual progress. In fact, it is this experience that is the common factor that you find among the mystics of all religious traditions. I mean, when you go beyond the ceremonies, rituals, dogmas and doctrines and belief systems, and when we draw ourselves inward, when we experience something within ourselves, then this is the experience. What's the experience? The world is nothing but God. Not the world that we see, but the essence of the world. See, we can't say this Lektaho is God, or this tree is the God, or this glass is the God. It's not that. Often people make fun of this. Rather, there is nothing in this world which is not pervaded by the divine spirit. And that divine spirit is not only all-pervading, it is not only omnipresent, it is also immanent within all of us. So all rituals, practices, karma yoga that we are discussing, all these are only means to achieve this goal. Now, these are the five levels of spiritual realization, of which is the highest. It is based on the concept of God and goddesses in Rigveda Samhita. In fact, this analysis was made for the first time by Paul Dusen. Of course, before him, Max Muller also made an attempt. And he was trying to give a modern analytical, rather an analysis of the evolution of Godhead in Rigveda Samhita when we first edited that. The first we begin with looking at nature. So when we see the mighty mountains, rivers, valleys, the infinite sky, everything, then a feeling of awe, a kind of excitement, exclamation. Then we see there is something transcendental, that is not empirical, that we can't understand or explain at empirical plane. So nature is equated with the infinite God. It's called pantheism. In its primitive forms, you find the writings of 19th century poets of England, like Wordsworth, Shelley, Keats, different shapes. But we can't say this religious mysticism. It's a kind of literary understanding of pantheism. So nature, external nature, is equated with God. At a higher level, you find behind this external natural phenomena, there is a divine reality that is regulating this natural phenomena, which is really the essence of the ancient Shinto religion of Japan, where they see a spirit, an invisible spirit behind the natural phenomena. It's called panitheism. The third stage of polytheism, where you equate every single natural phenomenon, sublimity and beauty, prompts you to think of a divine hand behind every single natural phenomenon. It's called polytheism. So different gods and goddesses and deities and so on. Then it is called monotheism, where we think of one absolute all presiding deity who is the chief among these gods and goddesses, divine beings. And then, of course, there is another state called henotheism, which is a tricky subject, which is often criticized. Sometimes it is called pretended monotheism. They use this not a very complimentary term when they criticize Max Müller for coining this expression. It's called henotheism. But, you know, again, it's based on Rigveda Sankhya. What he did was, see, there is one Sukta, Indra Sukta, I mean, a long hymn with hundreds of verses, or maybe a few verses. It depends. It varies from Sukta to Sukta. So the entire Rigveda Samhita has got nearly 1,017 suktas. Each sukta may have 190 or more, nearly 100 suktas, the longest, or maybe just a few. So in one sukta, one deity is extolled as the chief, and another sukta, another deity is extolled. It's called henotheism. And the highest one is monotheism, where you think of the absolute reality in transcendental, impersonal terms, where you look upon the absolute reality as beyond name, form, definitions, or verbalizations, or intellectual perceptions, something that could only be experienced in our inner life. This is the highest. Now, in the Isavasya Upanishad, interestingly, you find Karma Yoga mentioned in the first and second verses, and you also find the highest mystical experience is also referred to in the Isavasya Upanishad. So there is a link, there is a logical explanation for this juxtaposition of the highest ideal of Karma Yoga, which is somewhat empirical relatively, and the highest transcendental spiritual mystical experience, where you experience yourself one with the entire creation. So I shall, for example, for those who are interested, I can read out some verses which gives you an idea of the highest transcendental experience that is mentioned here. So there are two verses, sixth and seventh verses. Those who are interested can see, or I can explain, of course, in detail. So, one verse is this. Yastu sarvani bhudani atmanneva anupashyati sarva bhudeshu cha atmanam tato na vijigupsate. Yasmin sarvani bhudani atmaiva bhud vijanataha tatrakko moha kvashyoka ekattum anupashyataha. Ekattum anupashyataha means, you know, for a mystic. For the highest spiritual seeker, when I was sitting in my room, I listened to a heated conversation on a cart. It is a classical example. I'm very happy because even 10 minutes before the retreat starts, devotees and students get actively engaged in the highest mystical spiritual discussion. Is it great? So a cart was one such. Maybe according to modern thinkers, based on Rudolf Otto's interpretation of Eckhartian theology, Eckhart was the only great mystic who openly expounded this highest ideal of spiritual unity. The idea that creation is one. Spiritually, the whole humanity is one spiritual family. Now, this idea can be understood only against a monistic background. Not against a monotheistic background. Because if you believe that God creates this world and sits above and sets down rules and regulations, maybe sometimes a big stick in his hand frequently, and then offering, promising heaven and maybe threatening with eternal damnation. In such a situation, you can't see God's presence in his creation. So God and his creation are two different entities. But this particular verse says, you know, ekattum anupashyataha. That is the seventh verse. It means, yasmin sarvani bhudani atmanneva bhud vijanataha. means for a person, for a spiritual seeker, who sees unity of existence, who sees everything in this world, the whole creation within himself, and himself in the whole creation, what happens, you know, he will have no delusion, you have no misunderstanding. Ekattu means experiencing the highest spiritual unity. Now, this is possible only if you can think of God as one operating spiritual reality, a divine spark that's present everywhere, even in an atheist or an agnostic. That's why. Because even an agnostic and atheist also is able to speak, able to deny God, able to criticize the Bible as Ingersoll did, only because God, as a divine spirit within, enabled him to do that. So, that's the highest spiritual experience. Then the previous verse also is equally important. Yastu sarvani bhudani atmanneva anubashyati sarvabhudeshu cha atmanam tatona vijigupchati. The highest spiritual seeker who perceives all beings as non-different, non-distinct from his own atman, his own self. When he sees his own self, himself, in everything, then you know, he can't hate anyone. Tato na vijugupsade. He cannot. Mentally and physically, he cannot do any harm to anyone. Now, this is the highest spiritual experience. This is the highest stage of spiritual evolution, as modern thinkers have interpreted, in the light of the evolution of Godhood in the Rigveda Samhita. Now, when we try to practice this Karma Yoga as mentioned in the first verse of Ishavasya Vanishad, first it means Ishavasya Midam Sarvam Jagat. The entire world, the whole creation is pervaded by the divine reality. And then what happens? Then also, we don't go to a forest. We continue living in this world, doing our duty, performing our responsibilities. But whole vision, the whole approach, our whole perception of life and our attitude towards other fellow living beings undergoes radical transformation. That's the idea. That's one thing. We become more broad-minded. We experience this spiritual unity, kinship with other living beings in our interaction with others. In our own inner life, what happens? Tena chetena vunchita. Then we enjoy this world. We don't run away from the world, but we enjoy keeping in mind this world that we are enjoying is not distinct and different from God Himself. Then we do not enjoy the way we squeeze an orange. Rather, we enjoy through renunciation. Well, squeezing the orange again reminds me of a conversation which took place between Robert Ingersoll, whom we mentioned just now, and Swami Vivekananda. Swamiji refers to that conversation in his Inspired Talks. So, Robert Ingersoll, you know, he was a humanist. He was a lawyer. He was a great orator, and he was a terror of theologians. He was a critic of the Bible, as he understood it, maybe not correctly. But anyway, he was certainly a great critic. In fact, I can quote some of his words from distant memory. He said, someone ought to speak the truth about the Bible. The preachers dare not, because they will be driven away from the pulpit. I mean, these are some of the words which as far as I can remember.
The publishers do not, because they lose their subscribers. The college professors do not, because they lose their salary. Like that, he goes on saying, and then he criticized the Bible. So he was a great critique of theology, ancient theology. He had an interesting conversation with Swami Vivekananda, which in a way brings out the essence of the ideal of Karma Yoga as expounded in the Isavasya Upanishad. He told Swamiji, it seems, that, you know, this world is all that we have got, that we know of. So, this world is like an orange. Let us squeeze the maximum juice out of this orange, this world. Let us enjoy this world as much as possible. Not unlike the statements of J.S. Mill, Bentham, and others, the cutthroat utilitarian ideas. I mean, the validity of anything in this world is to be judged to the extent that it helps us to enjoy maximum amount of pleasure, maximum number of people. The Swamiji replied, and that reply is very significant when you read this verse. He said, "You are right, but I have a better way of squeezing the orange. Because for me, life is not just one chance. We need not pounce upon the orange and destroy it by squeezing the last ounce of the juice. We can slowly do that without damaging the orange." So, I mean, enjoying the orange juice without destroying the orange. So, enjoying this world, not by enjoying the great desire, attachment, and great zest for comfort and enjoyment, rather through the means of tyaga. So, tyaga and yoga, these are two important terms in the Isavasya Upanishad. Tyaga means renunciation. Yoga, of course, karma yoga. So, when we practice tyaga, then our action becomes spiritual action. It becomes refined, processed action. It becomes karma yoga, as I mentioned yesterday. So, when karma becomes karma yoga, I am continuing what I mean from where I left yesterday at this time. Now, when we link our action or karma to the tyaga or renunciation ideal, then karma becomes karma yoga. So normally, whatever we do, it binds us. When we are engaged in some action, we are anxious about the results, worried about the results. And when we have completed action, very frequently the results may not be up to the expectation. Then frequently we become disappointed. So there's a problem not only when we are doing the work, but also after we have done the work. And even if the work is successful, still the consequences in the long run may not be always desired. So before we start the work, there's a lot of anxiety, planning, headache. When doing work, then also there is anxiety. After finishing the work, there is also problems. So work by itself can never be perfect. No work can be perfect. You may say, well, if you follow the perfectionist ideal, your work becomes successful. But it becomes successful only in an external sense. We tried hard and we may have planned to make $1 million, we may have made $1.5 million, more than maybe $2 million. That's true, successful. But then after some time, if our mind is not happy, if we are not satisfied, not contented, because every work we do in pursuit of some happiness, some enjoyment, some little peace or whatever may be. No one does any work without looking for some real result beyond the empirical result. But the money that you have made may be lost up to some time. So this work is not perfect, because if the work is to be interpreted as a perfect thing, then it should always remain in a state of happiness, enjoyment. It never happens. So how can we call the work perfect? Karma perfect. But karma becomes karma yoga, and then it becomes perfect. That's a subject of discussion here. So as I said, work by itself can never guarantee to bring eternal peace and happiness. But at the same time, work is totally unavoidable. You cannot keep quiet. Lord Krishna was the first psychologist who made this statement. He says, Nahi kasikshanamabhi jadu tishtati akarma krita karidehi avashak karma sarvat pragvidehi gunai. He says, no one in this world can remain inactive mentally and psychologically and physically simultaneously. No one can remain perfect. Even if you are relaxing on an easy chair, mind will be active. So you are active. So where is the way out of action? Action is unavoidable, indispensable. You cannot run away from it. Na karmana manarambha naishkarmyam purushonasnadi Mr. Sanyasana Deva Siddhim Samadhi Gachari. Lord Krishna makes the same statement in the same third chapter. Na karmana manarambha. Now suppose you try to run away from action. You try to run away. Impossible. Kaya dehi avashak karma means you will be in a state of total helplessness. You have to do something. The richest man with the highest bank account, with the great reputation, friends and followers everywhere, also cannot run away from the necessity of action. Mental action or physical action. But no, impossible. But action, as I said, can never be perfect. So, how to face this problem? On the one hand, the total helplessness of not being able to avoid action. On the other hand, the helplessness that comes out of the naturally imperfect nature of all actions. So, the Upanishad devises this means. You link action with something else, some transcendental idea. Then this action becomes perfect. You don't stop action, you don't become negligent, you don't become indifferent, you don't become inefficient, with the same enthusiasm, with the same efficiency, the same zeal, you continue doing duties and responsibilities, but you avoid all these problems. How to do that when karma becomes karma yoga? In the Gita terminology, Lord Krishna uses the word non-attachment, anasati, meaning being totally non-attached to the results, unconcerned about the result, still concentrating on work at hand. This is the language used in the Gita. In the Isavasya Upanishad, it's a much ancient work. Maybe there's a gap of 3,000 years between Bhagavad Gita and Isavasya Upanishad. Isavasya Upanishad is at least 3,000 years earlier than Bhagavad Gita, which in a way is an interpretation. It's a commentary on the Isavasya Upanishad according to Mahatma Gandhi. Gandhi made a statement. He says that if all the Upanishads, all the scriptures vanish from the face of earth, if this small Upanishad remains on face of this earth, it's enough. Nothing will be lost. That's what Gandhi's own interpretation. He was a great admirer of this Isavasya Upanishad. And he himself formed this Anasati ideal on these first two verses. So Isavasya Upanishad says, you link your action with the Tyaga idea, the renunciation idea, and then continue enjoying. I mean, squeezing the orange the way Swamiji wanted. Not destroying the orange. But you need not be in a hurry. And Swamiji continues his conversation in spite of the universe. Because I am not going to die. See, you pounce upon the orange and you use all your muscular power to squeeze to get the last ounce of the juice, Because you are in a hurry, you have to catch a plane. In other words, you have only one life to live. Before you die, you have to finish all. Every single orange you have to squeeze and drink as much juice as you want. But Swamiji says, well, I am not in a hurry. Even after my death, I will continue. You can continue squeezing the orange next life also. Why should you worry? You can relax the mood, you can squeeze the orange. So you need not destroy the orange. And that's an important principle in the Karma Yoga idea. Suppose somebody asks you a question. Well, I have read all this, I'm trying to practice, but I'm not making enough progress, and I'm getting old, so I'm not sure that I will succeed in spiritual life. That's a big question. That's also one of the reasons for frustration and disappointment. Because frequently, when we encounter students and spiritual seekers who have a Brahmic theology, not that they believe in it, but at the background, very difficult for many of them to remember the fact that they are not going to die when they are dying. Death is really not death. Death is not a full stop. Death is only a semicolon or a comma. That's what it means. That's why Swamiji said, and it's crucial to understand this principle. In fact, the Gita, which again, as I said, is a commentary on these two verses, this idea is put in a very graphic language. Arjuna himself, the disciple in the Gita, puts this question to Krishna. Ask this question. Well, suppose you have taught me all this, yoga, karma yoga, devotion, advaita, everything. But suppose I do not succeed, or I don't make enough effort. You find this thing, you know, very frequently, sometimes, you know, mind revolves. Even listening to Dr. Vedanta, scriptural reading, again, at one corner of the mind, lot of irritability, lot of frustration, lot of discontentment continues, lot of conflict exists. Natural, nothing wrong in it. It is natural for every spiritual seeker. Sometimes run into a dead end. What appears to be a dead wall, there is no further progress possible. This is the question that Arjuna asked about. Ayadi shraddhiyo pedu yoga charida manasaha aprapta yoga samsiddhim kam gatim krishna ditsu. What is going to happen to me, to those people who do not fully succeed, who die, or who may have a deviation, a fall, who may feel that they are not making enough progress? Now, in answer to this, Lord Krishna gives a very elaborate answer, which is a great promise, maybe the most optimistic philosophy of life ever discussed in any world literature in the coming verses, where Lord Krishna answers this question. What will happen to me if I don't succeed? So Krishna answers, Partha naiveha namutra vinasas pasya vidyate nahi kalyanakrut kaschit durgadin tadagichhi. This is a great statement. You are not going to lose anything, and you are not going to be lost. Even if you have practiced a little in this life, to practice the tyaga renunciation, non-attachment. Do your best. You have made a great attempt, a sincere attempt, but you are sure you are not fully succeeded, because sometimes the mind revolves, sometimes there is a dark night of the soul, sometimes there is some, we feel, as I mentioned yesterday, spiritual life is not a straight line progression. From 0 to 3, you feel you have made a tremendous progress. You feel elevated. From 3 to 9, which is really much longer progress, you feel you are stagnant. Because after 3, after reaching the third stage, you may feel you are not making any progress at all. Because from 0 to 3, the distance is much longer than the distance from 3 to 9. If you think of the whole scale as ending with 10 devotees. So the whole point is,
Sometimes we misinterpret our own life. If there is some difficulty at mental level, doubt or depression, we sometimes feel we are not making any progress at all. It is really wrong. So Lord Krishna says, you are not losing anything. You are not going to lose in this world or next. Then he continues the statement. After death, you will be born again. But you won't be born with an empty slate, as John Locke said. Rather, you will be born with a slate in which everything is written. You will be born with a bag. The bag of samskaras, memories, impressions. It's called Purva Abhyasa. Purva Abhyasa ena tenaiva. So, what we have done in this life, we have prayed little, we have even listening to ideas also is very important. Because when we listen carefully, even if we forget immediately, those ideas have created everything, yoga philosophers say, a samskara within the mental system, and that vritti will not remain idle. It will sprout. It will become a plant. Maybe it will not sprout in this life. In the next life, suddenly you find it has become a sprouted plant and it bears fruits. That's why frequently, if I had spiritual seekers, born in communities or in families or social, cultural situations, it's a totally different, suddenly take a turn to spiritual life. You may call it a miracle, but it's really not a miracle. There's a cause and effect logic behind it. So Lord Krishna said, whatever you have done in this life becomes samskara in the next life. All these activities, thought currents, spiritual practices will have a cumulative effect. They create a spiritual capital. And you will be born with that bag. And when you get an opportunity to continue the same spiritual journey in the next life, you go ahead. So if somebody is walking through the streets of San Francisco and you find a meditation center or any place where spiritual practices are going on, if you feel certain attraction, you find the reason is you have done in the past. You're connecting. That's what Krishna says. Tatradan buddhi samyogam labhade paugadekigam. This is the last state, most important state. How does this really happen? Let us say we listen to a lot of lectures, we do pray, we attend pujas, all this. We do with a lot of concentration, but sometimes we feel that concentration is not enough. There is a lot of dissipation, disturbance, no problem. Lord Krishna says, when you are born again, This positive vrittis, vasanas, samskaras, impressions, memories, this constitutes certain characteristics. Will be born again with you. And when, and by the strength prompted by these samskaras, these memories, you'll be drawn towards a situation where you continue your spiritual practices in the next life. You cannot help it. That's why some spiritual seekers, even if some obstacles come, still they will disregard, they have thought, they will completely ignore all this and go ahead. Attending retreats, maybe attending prayers or whatever, reading scriptures or doing japa, meditation in their rooms, whatever. So even if there's an obstacle, You have a natural tendency to ignore all these obstacles and go ahead. This is the other way also. If our mind is not ready, if we do not have enough spiritual capital, then if we are born in a very wonderful positive atmosphere where spiritual practice becomes natural and easy, we may not do that. We go to Los Angeles, Las Vegas or the 49ers. This, so both ways it could happen.
So this is something which is special to Vedanta, and this is the key to understanding the dynamics of Karma Yoga psychology. So that's why an interesting message is, we don't lose anything and we are never late. It doesn't mean that we should have complacency, no. The point is, we should not be complacent, but at the same time, we won't lose anything. So every single spiritual effort will help us to go ahead and practice and continue practicing the next life. That is the unique message of this Upanishad. Now, in the same Upanishad, we are going to some other verses to the end of this text. So now, our discussion is not exclusively on this text. Our discussion is the idea of Karma Yoga and certain related topics related to spiritual life based on this Upanishad and related topics. So you find three verses which are very crucial. I shall read and then I shall try to explain. 15, 16 and 17. Hiranmayena patrayana satyasya apihidam mukham tattvam pushan apavunu satya dharmaya drishtaye. Is the 15th one. Then 16th one is pushan nekashe yama surya prajapatya vyuharasmin samoha tejo yatte rupam kalyanatamam tatte pasyami yosaroso purusha swakamasmi. Then this 17th one. Vayu danidam amudam athedam basmantam sariram om kradosmara kradamsmara kradosmara kradamsmara. These are very important verses in understanding the ideal of Karma Yoga is mentioned in this book. So we are going to discuss that. First, the 15th one. The literal meaning may not fully reveal the previous content. The literal meaning is something like this. There's a lid that's made of gold. It covers the sun. I mean, like a lid, your shining golden orb covers the entrance of truth. I mean, you are being hidden by a golden disc or plate or whatever. Please remove that. The prayer is addressed to the sun so that I am able to see you, behold you. This is the literal. Now, what is this golden disc? Now, these three verses are related to the experiences of a spiritual seeker who has practiced Karma Yoga, as expounded in this book. So let us think of an ideal spiritual seeker who has practiced meditation, Karma Yoga, detachment, all these great qualities. And then he is now about to die. This is the story, the picture. When he looks back, he doesn't have to worry about it. Complain about anything. But he still feels that somehow he is not able to have a clear vision of the Supreme Truth. He is not able to fully experience the reality of the Divine Atman within himself or in this world. Why? Because there is still some attachment to comforts, to external worldly pressures. So he's addressing a prayer and he pleads the sun god. Sun, he was meditating on sun as the Atman all his life. Please remove this golden disc, because this golden disc is hindering my vision. I am not able to have a clear vision of your true nature. So please remove this. This is the first verse. Now, The second verse says, again the prayer continues. Oh son, you are the son of Prajapati. You are the causer of the heaven. You control and support the whole creation. Please withdraw your extreme effulgence which blocks my vision, so that by your grace I am able to behold you. Now we are coming to the 17th verse, which is more intimately related to the subject. And then, now this devotee is praying to God, please lead me to my next destination. Let my last breath be merged in the all-pervading eternal prana, the Supreme Spirit manifesting as energy. And let my body be reduced to ashes. Oh mind, please look back and remember all the good things you have done. This is the prayer. Now, we are coming to the subject. First, the devotee pleads to God to give him a vision, a clear vision of Atman. Second, he prays to his own mind, look back and think of all the wonderful deeds he had done. This last verse is intimately related. Why does the devotee request his own mind? Why is he pleading to his own mind? Oh mind, look back and think of all the noble deeds you have done. That's the most important. So the devotee knows that he is going to die. He also knows that he is not going to die. Why? When he thinks that he is going to die, he understands it only means his body is going to be reduced to ashes. This body. But he also knows that he is the eternal Atman, it is deathless, it is going to remain immortal. Even if you are not fully realized this truth, that is the Atman, still he need not worry, because he will be able to continue his spiritual journey. He will be born in a family where he will be able to continue his journey. Now, in the Gita, discussing the same topic where I left last time, you know, the sixth chapter which I mentioned, when Krishna was answering Arjuna's question, Krishna makes a point, Athava yogina meva kule bhavati dhimaha. Edarhi durlabhadaram yogi jarma yadidhi. Now, Lord Krishna makes a statement to Arjuna. Suppose you die without reaching the highest spiritual goal. You don't have to worry. In fact, you don't have to worry at any stage of your life. A spiritual seeker should never worry. See, you may have to worry about certain duties, responsibilities in which you are engaged. You cannot become a moron. You cannot become insensitive. But it will never have an upsetting effect, a permanent impact in our system. Why? Because worry itself is the opposite of spirituality. We may have some difficulties which may make us think hard to find a solution, but that should not constitute worry in a deep psychological sense. So the devotee knows, see, bhasmantam sharira, my body is going to be reduced to ashes. It doesn't frighten him. See, death doesn't frighten him. Rather, death, he understands, death is like a transition point. When you are going from one place to another place, you have to change the plane. You don't get worried, oh, I have to get down this airport and wait for another. You don't worry about it. It's a transition. When you will continue your journey, your baggage will reach the destination. Like that, a spiritual seeker doesn't worry. So, his bhasmantam sharira,
have to take another flight, another plane. Like that, this body is going to be reduced to ashes. I may continue my spiritual journey in another body. So Lord Krishna says, if you have done spiritual practice, enough spiritual practice, or at least to some extent try to practice meditation, prayer, attending retreats, so anything that will feed your mind with spiritual thought currents. See, we should not interpret spiritual sadhanas as activities.
Mm-hmm.
Even going to San Francisco Public Library and you should take a good book, spiritually elevating book, spend 1 hour reading, that is also really not different from meditating in a church or a temple. Because any activity that fills the mind with spiritual thought currents, spiritual, it's called vrittis, samskaras, which is spiritual practice. On the other hand, if you meditate and thinking of something else, then this will become spiritual practice. So the whole point is, anything that we do sincerely in the direction of spiritual life creates a bank balance, a spiritual capital, and that is deposited in our name. When we are born again, we will be born with a checkbook and a fountain pen. So this is a real fact. That's why Lord Krishna says, "Tatratam buddhi samyogam labhade pauro dehi," means buddhi samyogam, you know, buddhi actually means antarkarma. Our samskaras, our characteristics, the cumulative effect of all that we have done in the past life, creating a particular samskara character, that is called buddhi. Samyoga means coming in contact. Tatra means next life. What happens? So this samskaras, paurodehiya means these samskaras you had in your previous body, previous. You are born with that, with those holy samskaras, spiritual vritti, spiritual vasanas, spiritual characteristics. Then you know what happens? Yadadevi. Then you continue working in the same direction. This is the great promise that Lord Krishna makes. Now, the devotee here is humbly pleading his own mind, or mind, be careful. Look back, think of all the spiritual practices you have done, all the noble deeds you have done, all the noble thoughts you have thought, any effort, anything you have done. Remember that, so that I will be born again in an appropriate situation. You know, athava yoginameva kule bhavati jimata. If you die with these memories in the mind, then what happens now? Next life, you are born again, you continue the journey. So absolutely no problem. So where is the scope of worry? So worry, depression, botheration, these constitute the very antithesis of Vedanta. So Vedanta is a science of spiritual optimism. You can find some very interesting stories in the Bhagavad Purana, which highlights. And you know, according to many scriptures, you have to remember, sometimes there is a misunderstanding, but not very much these days, that many of these ideas are possible only for monks or monastics or mystics. This is not possible for householders, grihastha. This is sometimes often an argument put forward. But according to Ishavasya Upanishad and commentators, grihasthas or householders themselves are divided into two categories. In Sanskrit it's called maukshika, the other one is called sadhaka. So those who do not leave the whole world, continue living their families, performing the duties and responsibilities. For them, they will also be born again in a situation or in a family, in a culture, in a tradition, where somehow they will get a chance to continue their spiritual journey. Sadhana. That is called moksha. There are many great devotees who live in their homes, who live like monks or nuns, but still they continue doing their duties, but still they give higher priority to spiritual practices. So udasina, so there is a udasina sadhagasya grihastho divido bhavet kudumba bharane yukta sadhago so grihi bhavet pranani trini abhakritya tyaktva bharidhanadikam egaki vijareyastu udasina samokshika. So this is an ancient verse which really explains this. I am going to drive home this idea with the help of an analogy from one of our spiritual classics. So there are two types of great spiritual seekers, even among those who have not taken to exclusive spiritual life. Living in the world, doing their duty, still they can become great devotees. They can reach the same destination. Now I am going to give this story. It is a very interesting story. It comes from another spiritual classics. This highlight is why. The story is about a spiritual seeker. His name is Ajamila. The Bhagavata Purana means Ajamila, Vakhyana means the story of Ajamila. Ajamila means A-J-M-I-L-A, who is spelled in English. So he was born in a family, a pious family. As a young boy, his parents were very pious people, led good life, ideal life, trained him properly, taught him the scriptures, and trained him in spiritual practices. So he led a very ideal life till he reached 16th or 17th year. So very pious family. Maybe he may have done a lot of spiritual practices in previous life, but not enough. So he was born in a family where he got a chance to be trained in these spiritual practices. But then as he became a full-fledged youth, he had a terrible deviation. He fell into bad company. He became a bohemian. He became a drunkard. He became profligate. He killed his own parents, who met terrible tragedies. So all the terrible things that should not happen happened in his life. Remember, this happened to a person who had good training when he was growing up. You may see a logical conflict between the early part of his life and what happened to him later. The fall and deviation and this bohemian lifestyle and so on. Finally, it was time for him to die. His lifestyle, his activities, his sinful criminal activities made him so notorious that he was driven away from his own family, his own home, his own village. And he was deserted by all the wrong people, bad people in whose company he lived. He became a pauper and he was about to die. Now, at that time, suddenly he remembered his son. Now, we have to remember, he had a son who was different. In those days, people may have married when they were 16 or 17 years old, and this great deviation, his fall, took place when he was 21 years old. And then his whole life was that of a bohemian. So, when he was about to die, he suddenly remembered his son. And his son's name was, incidentally, it was the name of God. You know, one of the synonyms, Narayana's name. Narayana is one of the synonyms of Lord Vishnu. One of the Hindu holy trinity. So he did not think of God at that time. He only thought of his son. Because he was in a state of total helplessness. All his companions were all
rogues left him because he became a pauper, so there was no one around him to help him. So he was in a state of total helplessness. So he called out his son. And his son was about to respond to him. By the time he died. Now, remember, he was not thinking of God. He was only thinking of his son. But when he called out his son's name, it also occurred to him for a split second. It flashed in his mind that that was the very holy name that he used to recite when he was small, in the temple, when he was growing up under his pious parents. So he had done a lot of spiritual practice when he was small. And he used to recite this holy name. This is the synonym of God. Though he did not remember that aspect, he was calling his son. But immediately, for a split second, for a flash of a second, he remembered, oh, that's a name that he used to recite as a pious little boy, growing up in his home, praying every day to God. And he died on the spot. So, this is the first part of the story. Next part of the story, you know, when he died, two sets of messengers came. A group of people came from hell, and another group came from heaven, let us say. So Vishnu's Narayana, Narayana is Vishnu's synonym, Vishnu sent these angels, and some devil also sent his lieutenants to catch him, to bring him to hell. So they were competing, they were fighting among themselves. This man belongs to us because he recited the name of Lord Vishnu when he was dying last moment. The last moment he remembered the name and form of Lord Vishnu. So he belongs to God, Vishnu. So we are here to bring him, to take him to the heavenly abode of Vishnu. Then the devil's messengers, called devil means, you know, Yama, let us say he's the god of hell. He's the one who controls, who regulates the punishment to be given out to, meted out to undesirable people who die. So the messengers of Yama, the lord of death, said no, he had done everything that he should not have done. And he did not do anything that he should have done. So such a fellow has no place in the abode of Vishnu, God. So he belongs to hell. Then Vishnu's angels tell them, look here, he may have done all the sinful things, but at last moment he remembered the name of God, though not consciously, unconsciously. So he deserves to go to heaven. So finally he was taken to heaven. Now, some of the interpreters who wrote commentaries on these stories say, why was he taken to the abode of God? One reason, he had already done a lot of spiritual practice in his previous life. And in this life also, he was born in a family where his parents trained him in spiritual practices. And till he reached his 15th year or so, he was brought up as a pious young man, and then he had a fall. But on the strength of his samskaras, vrittis, vasanas, the training he received in his previous life, he could remember that the name of his son was also the holy name of God. He did not call on God's name consciously, but he called his son's name. As a coincidence, the son's name also was the name of God. So they connected. So that helped him to go to heaven. This is a story. So the whole idea is, if anyone practices any spiritual sadhana, somehow linking of everyday activities, everyday thoughts, everyday responsibilities to a spiritual ideal, the transcendental ideal, then our activities, our whole life becomes spiritually surcharged. As I mentioned yesterday, you know, our normal activities correspond to a little stream where a little water flows for maybe 2-3 months of the year and then they get dried up. There are many narrow streams which are not perennial. They have water only for maybe a few months of the year. And then they will be dirty, filthy, bacteria or so. But suppose you link that narrow stream to the Lake Tahoe or to the ocean, and the water flows through that narrow stream, then becomes a perennial source of water. Like that, whatever we do in our life, whatever may be our obligations, duties and responsibilities, all these get a spiritual orientation when we link our life and activities to the spirituality. So Isavasya Upanishad present two wonderful ideas. One, the highest spiritual transcendental idea. The whole world is pervaded by the divine. There is no distinction between the secular and spiritual. The secular can be spiritualized. So, the distinction between the secular and spiritual is only an imaginary line of demarcation. So, once we link this little river of ours to the eternal source of perennial waters, then whole life gets spiritualized. Such a life becomes a yajna, as I mentioned. Yajna. I mentioned yesterday. So, the word yajna has got a number of interpretations. Devarodeshan Dravishatyagha Yajna is one. Shadabhada Brahma. It means Yajna can be an offering. You go to a temple or a synagogue or a church and you offer something in a very unselfish way to help somebody, it becomes a Yajna. But then there is higher Yajna. You spiritualize a whole life. Cut the thread that connects our actions and the results. Decide for the result. Then what happens, you know? Life gets spiritualized. Then it becomes the highest yajna. It's called yajnyovai sreshtatamam karma. Any action, any activity, any thought, any memory, any flash of ideas in our mind can become a spiritual offering. Then becomes yajna. Now, we start evolving in life to a higher level of spiritual evolution through this yajna. But for that, we need some conscious efforts. And one of the most important requisites for continuing the spiritual practice is saddha, a sincere desire to evolve, to look beyond the everyday life problems and to attach ourselves to a transcendental idea. We'll discuss this tomorrow. Now we'll have interaction for half an hour. So we can discuss, we can raise subjects and
that whatever action you do connect to the transcendental idea.
Yeah.
And also the samskaras which you accumulate through spiritual practice or secular work, they also create a samskara for your next life. So does this mean that the samskara which are created by the worldly thought or worldly action gets diminished by the spiritual samskaras?
Yeah. You know, after all, in our personality, subtle personality, this means a bag, like a bag. It contains good, positive, healthy samskaras, characteristics. patterns that you have inherited in the past. They also contain very wonderful samskaras, and they also contain some negative samskaras. So sometimes we feel mental block in spiritual life. So we have sometimes our mind creates artificial justification for not continuing spiritual practice. Oh, today I'm busy, I would rather skip it. No, or the other way is, oh no, I should not skip it, it's much more important. So there could be two contradictory approaches to spiritual practice. It's due to the conflict between the positive and negative samskaras, some characteristics they are accumulated in the mental system. So as we do more and more spiritual practices, then you know there will be more of positive samskaras and less of negative samskaras. And many of the conflicts in even the multiple personality, means schizophrenic problems, bipolar problems, some psychologists and psychiatrists, even mainstream psychiatrists, try to interpret them in the light of previous life and reincarnation. There's a trend which is may not be academically acceptable, but still there is a strong trend we find in many books. The point is, this conflict between positive and negative samskaras is a real thing. So how to solve the problem? Increase the positive samskaras. Try to do in whatever way possible, physically and mentally. Try to create and generate more and more positive, healthy samskaras through healthy actions, healthy thought currents, healthy associations. All these are very helpful in creating a huge reservoir of healthy, positive samskaras. And as the positive samskaras increase in volume, the impact or influence of negative samskaras will be reduced proportionally. That's why after some time we feel less of this mental block. In the life of spiritual seekers, this all typically happens, procrastination and postponement. Try to avoid. Sometimes you find, well, today I have to go to my office earlier, so I would rather meditate the evening, not morning. I would rather do that. Now, there may be two factors. There may be a genuine factor. Sometimes we want to avoid it. So we create a justification which may not be fully justified. So mind itself plays a game with itself. One part of the mind detaches itself from the mainstream and creates an artificial justification for not doing it. That is a manifestation of the negative samskaras. So you find this in the writings of Christian mystics also, put in a different language, in the influence, the temptation of the devil and so on. But in Vedanta, it's a natural play of the mind. Because the negative samskaras try to create a block. So what we must do, we must stick to doing things which create, which generate positive samskaras. Then the influence of the negative samskaras will be reduced, and proportionately the influence of positive samskaras will be increased. Then the mental block becomes less and less, as I believe.
So I presumably, like all people, I have a bank of some good samskaras and some bad samskaras. Now if I go to the bank, they will make an addition, and I will never come out with all good samskaras. So it's a question of...
Can we close that door? Because it completely blocks.
So I have some good samskaras and bad samskaras. But if I add them all up, I still don't have... The addition is not very favorable. So now my question is about grace. What, you know, why was Ajamila able to pronounce the name of Narayan at his dying door? Because he had many bad samskaras.
Yeah.
And good samskaras. So that sort of is akin to Christian grace. I mean, at his death, he somehow said Narayana.
Uh-huh.
So that is the dilemma. Am I bound by this addition and subtraction of good and bad?
Yes. Now, there's one way that's mentioned, you know,
So we can see this one way to confront the risk of generating negative samskaras through negative associations. That is, stick to one higher idea. I mean, a positive idea. Because once we stick to an idea in life, that creates a filtering mechanism which filters out possible negative samskaras. I mean, certain probable negative samskaras can be filtered out by reading scriptures, by sticking to certain ideas. And in the case of this particular devotee in Ajamila, what happened, you know, he had practiced so much of spiritual practices in this life, in previous life, but still had a deviation. That is, again, the influence of some negative samskaras which may come from previous life. That's why Swami Vivekananda makes an interesting statement. You have to understand, there are many statements in Swamiji, just as there are statements in great spiritual teachers everywhere. You find which are not very explicit and which cannot literally be obvious, the meaning. He says, every spiritual seeker has to go through the whole process of human spiritual evolution. Yeah. And he makes this statement in the context of Buddha. See, Buddha Jataka takes 554 previous lives he had to go through. So, all these images and memories and samskaras and vrittis flashed in his mind, which are now available in Jataka takes. What does it mean? He had to take so many births, so many lives he had to go through, till he was born as the real Buddha. Like that, when we take the spiritual life, suddenly you find there are new obstacles and problems and risks that suddenly emerge. If you sit quiet somewhere, without bothering about Vedanta, religion, spirituality, no problem. No conflict. But the moment you take a spiritual life, suddenly, if you are sitting quiet reading newspaper, New York Times, no problem. If you sit quiet and try to meditate, problems arise. So, is the problem created by meditation? No. So, it's like, there's a lake with a lot of filth and bacteria accumulated at the lower layers, you take a big stick and stir it. Without that, you cannot clean up the lake. So meditation or taking the spiritual life is like taking a long stick to clean up the lake. It's natural. So how to confront this? So the only way to confront is to remember that the lake by its true nature is pure. So it's natural for these thought currents and ideas to spring up, to emerge. Once we understand this, we will be short like this. And again, mentally, if you can keep in mind, my true nature is not this changing mind. My true nature is the eternal, ever pure Atman. That's my true nature. That's my real home. That's my true identity. This changing mind, this conflicting mind, all these problems are foreign bodies, which we want to get rid of. So, what's our true identity? Our true identity is that we are the Atman, the blissful, eternal, pure, divine spirit. That's our true nature. Every spiritual practice is an attempt to rediscover this thing. It's not some new knowledge that's coming. We are opening the doors and windows so that we will be able to find out what we actually are. So once we keep this in mind, naturally, mind evolves a filtering mechanism which automatically filters out negative associations and memories. And, see, let us say, the example of the story comes in the Mahabharata and other states. A lion cub was brought up among the lambs. He thought it's a weak lamb. And when he understood his line, it became different. So if he can remember the true nature is Atman, then even if you are in the company, in the association of people who may give negative influence, still won't be affected by that. That's the idea behind. So, you know, our true nature is that we are the ever pure heart. That's our true identity. So that's the identity card. If somebody has identity card, we know it's not mine. This is my true identity card. We can keep this in mind. That conviction, at least as an intellectual conviction to begin with, will automatically filter out all wrong ideas. How can Atman worry about anything? Mm-hmm. Worry is the mental level, intellectual level, sensory level. But I am something beyond the senses, beyond mind, beyond intellect. Not that we will ignore it, we will face those problems at their level, but their level is not our true level. We have a higher, we belong to a higher level. So this self-conviction creates a filtering mechanism. You can have a strong armor plate. I say yes.
So this is what Sri Ramakrishna called grace of your grace of the mind.
Yeah, grace of the mind. Mind itself becoming the guru. Mm-hmm. A pure, refined mind will lead you to the right goal. But it should be pure mind. So, in fact, what I mentioned just now, you know, when the ocean is linked to the little rivulet, the stream, then there is no difference between the ocean and the river, the stream. So long as there is water in the ocean or sort of the lake Taco, you water the stream also, and they are going to remain the water. So once we link ourselves to that transcendental reality, then that becomes our true identity. So then mind really, that means mind becomes non-mind. It's called amani bhava, means mind ceases to be mind. That is a term used in Vedanta and also in yoga, where when the mind is always in a state of flux, confusion, conflicting ideas, it is mind. When the mind is linked to Atman, then it is no more mind. Because mind in its true nature is subject to changes, fluctuations, conflicts, but actually. When it is linked to the Atman, then it is no more mind. Then mind becomes your guru. That's what Siddhartha says.
So Swami, how do we recognize when mind becomes the guru?
No, it becomes self-explicit. See, the real spiritual experience doesn't require any logical explanation, any identification marks. There are a few things, even in empirical life, which are self-evident, self-explicit. So when we reach that level of experience, or even to the bit of flash of it, your doubt slowly begins to vanish.
Because normally in a human being, there's sometimes when we are reasoning, there's a part mind
direction. I can give an example. Right. When you are able to sit somewhere and listen to prayer, meditation, or talks on spiritual topics, but you don't feel like running away from it, what does it mean? Your mind is the same frequency. Your mind is linked.
Connected.
The river is linked to the ocean. Then, and you know, nobody needs to tell you, oh, these spiritual retreats are good. Nobody needs to tell you. You know it very well for yourself. So even at the ordinary level, you find certain things are self-explicit, self-evident. You don't need... it is because it is within our own system. We experience the reality of that within ourselves. So it doesn't require a flashlight to... reveal it. You know that story of Janaka, that Rekul Jyoti Brahmana, I mean, Dhridharanyagamanishad, is a great story, is there. We have to take it up another subject. No question.
So, Robert Ingersoll wrote about the conversation. Was he convinced about what Vivekananda said?
There is no evidence to. but I think. He had a high opinion about Swamiji, which means Robert Ingersoll was not a naive person. He was a great humanist, he was a great orator. Robert
Green Ingersoll. He was a great critic of biblical theology, maybe mostly the mainstream dogmatic theology. Perhaps he was not a critic. He was a great thinker. We don't know, but perhaps since he had a high opinion about Swamiji, it's possible that he had a different idea. We don't know. I can't answer. I'm not sure about it. But he is still remembered as an agnostic and as a biblical critic.
The Ishavasya Upanishad, that is that the oldest Upanishad?
No, not the oldest. The oldest Upanishad must be Brihadaranyaka and Chandogya, which are the largest. Ishavasya is one of the older ones.
Before Gita, that's what.
Oh, long before Gita. Because Gita refers to all the Upanishads.
Yes.
Gita is itself Sarva Upanishado Bhavo. Gita itself is the condensation of all the previous Upanishad texts.
Some of the verses are like...
There are common words that's true. That they may have... No, yeah. They mostly incorporated from the Katha Upanishad. That's true.
Swami, Robert Ingersoll say to Swamiji that if he had come 25 or 30 years earlier, that he would have been stoned and crucified.
Yes.
But the atmosphere had changed.
Yes. Oh,
Emerson
yes.
and Thoreau.
Yeah. He himself was not stoned. That is true.
No.
Like he was a highly respected.
No,
I mean, America had become very liberal. The intellectual liberality was, especially in the East Coast, you know. America had become a very liberal country. Even European countries have become, reached a very high level of intellectual liberalism. You know. See, Unitarianism was not persecuted. Though it had its origin in 1784 in England, it was not persecuted. So...
Well, and also Emerson had done a great deal to prepare the
true. Emerson caught from the Gita, the Germans, but he was not persecuted. He was respected for
Emerson and Thoreau.
Yeah. Brahma has got two verses which are almost literal translations of two verses in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita.
Emerson's verse.
Yes. So we will continue the discussion. Any more questions? 5 minutes more.
Oh, I came across a quote. You know, you just mentioned Brahma, Brahma in Emerson's poem says, "They reckon ill who leave me out."
Yeah.
And I thought that's just such a beautiful
thought. In the Brahma, there is a the killer doesn't know this is killed. One is a quotation from the second chapter.
Yeah.
19th the verse, the slayer. 19th verse of the second chapter, Gita, find almost a literal translation.
Yeah.
Because he got a copy of the Gita translated by Charles Wilkins from
the 18th century.
Yeah, 19th century, he went to England, and I think the social critic Carlyle presented him with a copy of the translation of Gita by Charles Wilkins in English. So that's how he got his first copy. Nahanyate hanyamani sharire.
And there's that wonderful story about Thoreau, who ordered all the Asian translations he could get, and he built a special bookcase in his house.
Thoreau.
And when they came, he put all of these texts, the Gita and the Upanishads, in these, you know, on these shelves that he had built, and he just adored them.
See, there's a contrasting study as how European intellectuals approach Vedanta and American intellectuals approach Vedanta. So it's very interesting. In Europe, they study Sanskrit grammar, the scriptures, edited. But they didn't necessarily become mystics.
Uh-huh.
They were not transported mentally, emotionally into Vedanta.
But when immersion Toru and Whitman others came in contact with Eastern mysticism through theosophy and so on, it really changed their life. So, you know, in Europe, for example, Max Mulder, Paul Wilson, MacDonald, many great intellectuals and Sanskritists, especially Germany. But none of them became mystics the way Emerson became a mystic or Thoreau became. So there's a contrasting study. There are one or two books, well-known books written on this subject.
Thoreau became like a yogi,
don't you?
I mean, you know, he was so close to being a yogi.
A European intellectual may spend 40 years, 50 years, 60 years to study a language and spend his whole time, but he won't grow a beard and go and sit near a lake or meditate on the sky. That's against their their cultural conservatism. But here, when they get something, they want to go straight to it and practice it. That's what happened to the great mystics of America, like Emerson.
Did Master Eckhart, did he have any exposure to
that? There is no evidence to, historically, no evidence. But if you read Rudolf Otto's interpretation, you can see many of statements in Eckhart read like the translations of many statements in Shankara's commentary, Bhashya. So, for example, the idea that the absolute reality, the Godhead, is beyond the realization. Since Shankara's commentary, you know, Pancha Shabda Pravati Nishetha, I mean, the absolute reality cannot be verbalized, defined, or described, or explained. It can only be experienced. So these ideas, which are so well established in Shankara's philosophical tradition, you find in Eckhart. So there is a gap of nearly 500 years between the two great thinkers. So
maybe realized souls. You know.
Yeah, maybe.
That's funny. You also think there may have been some connection between the Upanishadic material with the ancient Greek or even previous period.
Yeah,
some interaction may have been.
Yeah, there is a view like that, you know. So, see, Heraclitus was a contemporary of Buddha. Thales is in Heraclitus, contemporaries of Buddha, 5th century BC. And many of the Greek mystery religions had impact of Upanishadic mysticism in some of their teachings. So, and also in Neoplatonism, the writings of Democritus, Philo, Porphyry, but the general view is the Constantine's conversion into Christianity, and after Christianity became the national religion of the Roman Empire, the church completely detached itself from the pre-Christian Greek mystery tradition. They highly enriched the early Christianity. So the early Christianity was highly influenced by the Greek mystery religion. So, with the Council of Nicaea, 325 AD, and Emperor Constantine's conversion, declaration of Christianity as the national religion of the Roman Empire, and of course later on with St. Augustine's emergence and his concept of radical sinfulness of man, many of these ideas which are highly arbitrary, which we don't know to what extent could be justified, the original teachings of Jesus, which are so universal, so spiritual, and so divine. So, sometimes it happens. When spirituality becomes theology, it comes down several steps below. Spirituality and theology. Theology is a received system, straitjacket, and it becomes highly institutionalized. Without institutionalization, many of these teachings cannot be preserved or propagated. But institutionalization also brings some difficulties. So that's natural. Everywhere it's natural. So thank you. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Pranamastu.